Good morning and welcome to this month's Hancock and Whitney Bank's Economic Update Call. Hancock Bank and Whitney Bank provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions during the call, please email them to david.lundgren@hancockbank.com and it will take the questions at the end of the call. Today we have Chief Investment Officer John Portwood and Investment Directors Greg Holiski, David Lundgren, Luther McDougall, and Jeff Tangus. With this, I'm going to pass the call on to the moderator, David Lundgren.
Great. Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. John, let's just go ahead and start out with the sequester. That's been the focus of all the headlines and has consumed a lot of the press in regards to what's going on in Washington. If you could, for our listeners, let us know what it means and what is the overall impact, I guess, both to the economy and the markets.
Just to bring everybody up to speed, in case you haven't been following this closely in the news, the sequestration process is one that automatically cuts spending across the board in most government agencies, and it was designed, as we all know, about a year or so back to go into effect if Congress and the administration were unable to agree on some sort of spending reduction plan. And it went into effect last Friday. Probably the impact will be relatively mild, depending on a relatively short life for this thing. There's not much impact if it goes through September, according to the numbers I've seen recently. And it doesn't obviously all occur at one time. If it lasts past September, then it'll have progressively, greater impact on economic activity. But the real problem, of course, is I think many of you have heard the law or the ruling, whatever you want to call this thing, doesn't give the agencies any discretion as to where and how to cut back. So yes, you just have to cut across the board, which can create some issues. Recent reports suggest that work is being done to come to some sort of agreement whereby agencies will be able to better manage the situation, where they won't have to cut completely across the board and kind of moderate the impact that this might have. In terms of impact on GDP, the numbers I've seen tend to suggest that at worst, it might be 0 to maybe 0.5% of GDP, depending on how long it lasts and whether or not, some agreements are reached to make it a little better. But that's basically what's going on. It's in progress now. There probably won't be a great deal of impact from it for a while. And even if it does exist for some time, it's probably not an economy killer.
Okay. And I guess while we're talking about Washington, there's two other big issues out there looming that could have some potential impact, maybe even in greater than the sequester, and that's the debt ceiling and then I guess a possible government shutdown. I think March 27th, the end of this month is when all that will come to a head. Explain to us what needs to happen there and what the potential impact there is as well.
Okay, the March 27th issue is what they call the continuing resolution to continue funding the government. And obviously that has a lot of discord over that would have a bigger impact on the economy than the sequestration issue that we're going through currently. And then as Dave said, right after that, well, several months after that, we've got the debt ceiling issue coming up again. And the various political players are beginning to devise their negotiating tactics, I guess, or their negotiating items to bring to the table as these situations arise to try to, work out some sort of compromise, I guess. Without going into a lot of detail, and we could probably spend an hour or two just talking about the different forces at work and the different plans that have been put forth and the different things that we're hearing in the news, it looks like some attempt is going to be made to make the continuing resolution and the debt ceiling limit if not a non-event, something that's more moderate in tone. Now, whether or not, we'll actually reach that point or not is anybody's guess, I guess, because, on some issues, the parties involved are pretty far apart. But at least there's some discussion going on currently to try to, you know, minimize those, you know, those points when they arise. And I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But certainly none of this is particularly positive for the economy.
Right. And I know it's hard to remove those issues from the economy, but, you know, if we could, maybe let's just talk about where we are in regards to economic growth. And I think last month when we met, fourth quarter real GDP came in initially at minus 0.1%. It has since been revised to positive 0.1%. Small change, but maybe psychologically meaningful as we move back into positive territory, and there's still one more revision to go. And we're right now we're kind of in the home stretch of the first quarter. So are you expecting similar results for the first quarter, or have we seen some improvement from that near zero number that we saw in the fourth quarter?
First quarter looks like it's going to be somewhat better. The estimates I've seen vary from 1% to 2%. If you look at the coincident economic indicators that tend to, you know, measure from week to week and month to month, you know, what's going on in the economy, they're either, you know, slightly above average or slightly below average in terms of potential GDP growth. So, you know, it looks like this quarter is going to be a little bit better than, I guess in percentages terms, it ought to be a lot better than what happened in the fourth quarter. But if you average the third quarter of last year and the fourth quarter of last year, you come up with roughly 1.5% GDP growth, which is probably not far below what potential is at the present time. And third quarter number of 3% apparently was larger because a lot of government spending was brought forward into that quarter, you know, in anticipation of sequester and a lot of things that might be happening this year. And then the fourth quarter of last year, you know, missed that entirely, you know. And so you really need to probably average the two together. You had a big increase in government spending in the third quarter. It almost went to zero in the fourth quarter. And that probably had a lot to do with that, you know, tremendous shift from one quarter to the other. The leading indicators are still positive. You can't find too many leading indicators that don't suggest we're still in an expansion and, you know, we're not at the cusp of recession yet. But obviously the level of activity is very low. And, you know, it may remain there for quite some time. One thing that is kind of interesting, when we first came out of the recession in 2009, or as we, you know, we thought we were leaving, you know, recession in 2009 and beginning some sort of recovery and expansion, you know, using history in terms of what happens after major credit busts, you know, we made a guess that maybe GDP growth on a trend basis was probably closer to 2% than 3%, you know, what we had been used to in the past. And since then, growth has been roughly 2%, and up to this point, however, a lot of economists and the academics economists who are always think linearly, I guess, and always are projecting something will get better down the road, including the Fed, you know, based on their activity, have been projecting, you know, 3% GDP just around the corner. We've never had it. Now it looks like consensus has shifted to 2%. I think everybody just about now is in that 2%. Camp in terms of GDP growth for the next year or two, as a guess, and I guess that appears to be fairly reasonable. And we're seeing more and more reports from, you know, thinkers in the business who are suggesting that perhaps we have reached a tipping point of some sort, and maybe, you know, trend growth is 2% for a long period of time instead of 3. You know, we may not ever get back to where we were, but you know, we don't know whether that's going to work out or not. But it looks like there's more of a movement now toward a generally lower level of estimate for the economy generally than there was before. So I guess now from a contrarian standpoint, we probably ought to be looking for evidence that it might turn out to be something different, you know, and maybe a little bit better. But in any case, it still looks like we're in that 2% range. Something else to think about why we're here and what needs to happen based on historical examples to get something more solid going in the future we need more savings. And you can look at that from the standpoint of a figure called net national savings, which looks at government deficits and their size, and corporate investment and personal savings. And in the past, when those three factors together have been fairly high, indicating a fairly high level of net national savings, it has provided a base for pretty substantial GDP growth going forward and employment gains and consumer spending gains over time. Now, however, we're in a position where looking at that data, it's too low, and it probably, and it's more associated with lower consumption and lower GDP gains and that sort of thing going forward. So it took us probably 30, 40 years to get into this situation, and it may take us a number of years to get out of it. But in any case, when the economists look at it, this is what they point to as suggestive of a different trend level in GDP growth until, you know, some of these imbalances are removed and debt levels are reduced. So, you know, hopefully we'll get there sooner rather than later. But in any case, that seems to be kind of where we are.
Well, what's interesting is the stock market doesn't seem to be too concerned about some of the headwinds that you discussed. And, Greg, are you there with us this morning?
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. February, not quite as exciting as January from a market perspective. The S&P 500, we'll go over the numbers. S&P 500 was up 1.4% in February. Similar numbers for the Dow, up 1.8%, and the Russell 2000 up 1.1%. And, Greg, when I clicked on the WallStreetJournal.com this morning, they have a tracking the Dow record, a little chart going, and I guess that's all the buzz is people are talking about a new record for the Dow, and we're actually through it this morning, and closing in on the S&P 500. Is there any significance to that number?
Well, there's always a psychological barrier, but it tends to be one that probably impacts the average retail investor. They don't look at it from a market historical perspective. I mean, you really need to look at it relative to what's going on in the economy and from a historical perspective. If you think about it this way, if you were to take a long-term price chart of the market and put a picture frame on that map or on that chart and move it around at various points in time, more often than not, the right-hand side of the frame was generally the highest the market has ever been. For example, back in 87 when I started in this business, the Dow was at 2,400, when a 100-point up or down day meant something much more significant than it is today on a percentage basis. Now we're talking about a Dow 14,000. I guess what investors need to keep in mind is that the market reflects the health of the economy, and as long as the economy continues to grow, it should translate into higher equity prices.
You heard John's comments, and, you know, I guess the obvious question whenever we're talking about the stock market and we've gone through a pretty incredible period, you know, coming out of the financial crisis in 2008, obviously we're, you know, made a nice rally from there. Given, you know, the economic backdrop of slower economic growth projected going forward, are earnings going to be strong enough to support this rally?
Well, I think we need to take a look at what I've been telling people is that, you know, the markets move pretty fast. So I think, you know, can the rally be sustained? Yes and no. No in the short term, because I just would not be surprised that we see some kind of a pullback or corrective action. I thought that might actually be happening in February, but then we got some stronger numbers. But the S&P had actually rallied 6.5% within the first 5 weeks of the new year, which is unsustainable in my opinion. You annualize that kind of growth, it'd be about an 80% return for the year. So as I said, I thought we were getting a little correction, but then we did see some economic statistics that were positive. I mean, it continues to be a mixed bag out there. And there was a little more volatility in February. But if 2013 is anything like the last several years, we had a strong start to the first quarter, perhaps the pullback occurs in March. We may get another surprise out of Europe, or the market just gets tired and takes a breather. In the long term, though, I think, yeah, it can be sustained. As long as we continue to see improvement in the economy and earnings don't collapse, the fundamentals can support higher stock prices. The other issue would be, you know, do we have multiple expansion or does, you know, do earnings continue to go? I think it could be a combination of both. The current forward 12-month PE is around 13 times. PEs tend to have an inverse relationship to interest rates, and in this lower rate environment, we could support higher PE multiples, but we need to see stronger growth in earnings, too. In terms of earnings, over 95% of the companies have reported, and 71% have reported EPS above mean estimates, so that's a positive. Earnings growth rate at the end of the year was only about 2.5%, but we're not breaking records. But if you look at the blended rate, which includes companies that are not reporting, it's about 4.2. In terms of revenue, 65% of the companies reported actual sales above estimates, and that's better than 61% in Q3 of last year and better than the 41% in Q2. So, again, not exactly record-setting growth, but reasonably good considering the GDP figure that came in for the fourth quarter. So, overall, you know, again, unless we slip back and this, you know, GDP remains flat, I think there's still some positive upside in the market. It's just that we're probably going to experience some kind of a pullback in here and get some more realistic numbers.
All right. Thanks, Greg. You know, another factor that I think has been contributing to the market is, and we've talked about it on past calls, the Federal Reserve's quantitative easing program. And it's been an unusual month in February because you normally see a pretty consistent message coming out of the Fed. And February was unusual in that the minutes revealed that some Fed governors had concerns about the consequences of an open-ended program that we're in currently. And that kind of affected the market when the minutes first came out, and then Fed Chairman Bernanke came out and dispelled that and, you know, basically said it would remain in place until further notice, I guess. And Luther, if you could, you know, if you could give us a little color on why we're getting such a mixed message, and is it anything to be concerned about at this point?
Okay, I think we need a little history to put this in perspective. The Fed has been in an easing mode and has had interest rates or the Fed funds rate in this 0 to 0.25% range since the fourth quarter of 2008. It's been a long, hard road. A lot of different things have been tried, QE1, QE2, or QE infinity. And it finally looks like, you know, we're past the beginning and maybe in the middle innings of this particular game. But we're beginning to see signs of sustained levels of growth. You know, we've seen the unemployment rate drop from 10% to 7.9%. We've seen housing rebound. The automobile industry is doing well. And we're seeing other signs, although not robust, but moderate signs that we have a reasonable level of growth going forward. So now it's time for the Fed to start thinking about how are they going to get us out of this, I won't call it mess, but this particular predicament. And what's come up this particular month is that one of the Fed governors, like you said, mentioned that it looks like we have some overheating in leveraged loans and junk bonds as people reach for yield, because we know the yield on money market funds is effectively zero. And one of the Fed presidents said that we've hit some historically historically high prices on certain pieces of farmland. So the Fed is beginning to, or some of its members are to, questioning where are we in this cycle of the Fed easing. Is it time to start reducing the Fed purchases, which they continue to make? Is it time to stop the Fed purchases? I think this is a very healthy discussion internally within the Fed, and it has come out to let everybody in the marketplace know that the Fed is aware of these particular issues, is contemplating, you know, how to deal with the particular issues. But like you said, at this point in time, Bernanke and the number two person, Yellen, have both come out and said, you know, the risk is still that if we stop making Fed purchases or raise interest rates, the economy is not strong enough at this point in time to support the end of easing. So, you know, maybe we're now beginning come close to the beginning of the end of this cycle, but you know it may be another 2 or 3 years before we actually reach there. But the Fed is beginning to discuss what they need to do next and to make sure the market knows that they're aware of all of the conversations that take place behind closed doors.
Great, Luther. Thank you. I think as we move forward, it'll be interesting. At some point, they're going to have to map out an exit strategy, and I have a feeling we'll be talking about it in the future. Jeff, let's talk a little bit about interest rates, and not a whole lot of excitement there. You haven't seen, we've been in a trading range, I guess, for quite a while. Anything noteworthy that you'd like to discuss in terms of interest rates or the bond market?
Well, I think the fact that rates did not increase dramatically is noteworthy in itself, given the fact that probably the biggest competition that the bond market has lately is just the stock market, which has been doing quite well. So one of the concerns that we have in the bond market is competition from stocks, and when the stock market's doing well, are people just going to go out and sell bonds and purchase stocks? Actually, looking at the flows, what we see is people aren't really selling bonds. What they're doing is taking cash and buying more stocks. So we haven't seen what they call the great rotation out of bonds and into stocks. And so that means that interest rates, especially on government securities, has been relatively stable, as you said, in that trading range, somewhere between 1.6% and maybe 2.1%, somewhere around 2% trading range. So in that regard, it's actually been stable, and for the month of February, Treasury rates were actually down a little bit despite everything else. So the bond market continues to show strength and tends to confound a lot of the skeptics, actually. So from the Treasury standpoint, it's been fairly stable. A couple of major events that we've had outside of the Treasury market lately in the corporate bond market. One thing that caused corporate spreads to widen just slightly this past month, which is the first time in many months, actually, is that we're starting to see some mega mergers or LBOs, leveraged buyouts, actually. We had two that were announced recently, Dell Computer, one that most people are familiar with, that company, and Heinz, the ketchup folks. Both of these companies, leveraged buyout offers were extended, and it looks like those deals will get done. And why that's relevant to the corporate bond market is you take somebody like Dell, which was a relatively well-capitalized, conservatively run company with lots of cash and low debt, and you have a leveraged buyout come in where the amount of debt is increased dramatically, and so if you're a bondholder, you go from a very solid, conservatively run company to a very highly leveraged company. Obviously, that's not a good thing from a bondholder standpoint. The shareholders did well because the common stock shareholders made a good profit on that buyout, but from a bondholder standpoint, it's a negative. Same thing is true on Heinz, not quite as pronounced, but generally speaking, that's considered to be a risk from a corporate bond investor standpoint. The probability that there could be more of these leveraged buyouts, primarily because of the low interest rate environment and the fact that the economy continues to get better, albeit sluggishly, that makes a prime environment for doing these sorts of things. So that's something that we've had to keep a close eye on here more recently, given the fact that we have a heavy commitment to the corporate bond market in our portfolio. So those are the two things recently that I think are most relevant in the bond markets.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. If anybody has any questions, please go ahead and email them to me at david.lundgren, L-U-N-D-G-R-E-N, at hancockbank.com. I do have one more question, John. In Greg's comments, he kind of alluded to what possibly could put some fear in the stock market. He talked about the Eurozone a little bit. And in the month of February, we had some elections in Italy that resulted in a divided parliament and raised concerns about austerity programs going forward in that country, which, of course, led to concerns about their debt once again. What's going on in the Eurozone? Is that something that we may see more issues arising as we move into summer?
It's quite likely. The Italian situation and the pushback politically against austerity appears to be part of the austerity fatigue that has set in, maybe the last year or so. There have been, there have been quite a few demonstrations against austerity and so forth, mainly in Greece, but a few hundred thousand people marched in Portugal the other day protesting austerity measures. So far, the only country in the Eurozone that's managed to make a success out of austerity is Ireland. According to the recent data we see, they appear to be improving economically after going through a pretty severe and austere cutback in government spending and all sorts of things. That had not been the case in the other Eurozone countries. And, at bottom line, I guess, the issue is still one of solvency and not liquidity. So this is going to continue for a while. France and Germany got together after the first of the year and agreed among themselves to some sort of plan to protect their banks in the event of a European catastrophe, and they didn't invite anybody else to participate in the talk. So observers looked at that and said, well, France and Germany are protecting themselves, and so it looks like we're some distance away from, let's say, some different form of political union or banking union. So I guess the crisis continues. The good news, I guess, is that even though a great deal of the southern periphery of Europe is in depression and or recession, and even the northern European countries, well, say like Germany and France, are not doing all that well, at least it doesn't appear to be getting any worse. So, things just are not improving, relatively quickly, but the potential for disruption is always there, and I guess that's something we'll have to live with for quite some time.
Okay. Well, thank you, John, and thank you, everybody, for joining us this morning, and look forward to talking with you next month.